Hola, ITT listener. It's Maria.
Hola, and it's Julio.
Always trying to imitate me.
Hola. I always try. I never make it, but, you know, I do my best.
So listen, fam, you know, given the news of what happened with the Supreme Court, and I can't believe I'm saying this, the likely possibility that it will be overturning the landmark case Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
We're going to share an episode that we recorded back in 2020, all about reproductive rights, with Michelle Goodwin, law professor and author, and Mary Ziegler, a legal historian. So in this episode, we get into abortion rights and the criminalization and repression of reproductive rights for women of color and who are immigrants. Because we know that this country has a history of policing women of color, trans people, immigrants, and their bodies.
Yeah.
And that's what these anti-abortion movements are really rooted in. So we're going to have that conversation.
Right. And what's really striking about this episode from 2020 is that at that time, we were talking about the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett, right? And what this would mean for the future of Roe. And it was 2 years before that, in 2018, remember this, when we were watching the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Man, pre-pandemic was like...
It's been gross for a while, bro.
Remember that? And we had a conversation on In the Thick about the fate of Roe back then, too. So, you know, we've been following this and wanted to kind of provide some context. And so now, after three conservative justices have been appointed to the court under the Trump administration, it's not surprising to see this draft decision from the Supreme Court to overturn these protections. This is what Republicans have been working towards for decades.
Decades playing the long game. And the Democrats are just like, wow, United States is such a cool country, man. We elected a black president, man. Everything's going to be cool. It's like, no. You cannot sit on our laurels, as it said.
Mm.
So let's go back to when it was that we recorded this episode. We were just months away from the 2020 election.
Yeah.
We weighed what a Biden or a Trump administration might mean for the future of reproductive rights, right? So this was before the presidential election.
Yeah.
We're getting our answer with President Biden. We're hearing from Democrats that the only way to protect abortion rights is to vote. We also know that black and brown voters have, in fact, come out in record numbers to vote for the Democratic Party. Right?
Yeah.
We know this. So let's take a quick listen to an interview by our producer, Harshana Hatta, last week with Rachel Guerra Lorenzo, who is executive director of Indigenous Women Rising, which runs an abortion and reproductive health fund.
That's really frustrating to hear that voting is the way that we could have gotten out of this situation, because we have a president who only this week said the word abortion. If we can't even say the word and acknowledge it for what it is, then a lot of us don't have faith in our government to protect our rights, especially as Indigenous people.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Julio, one thing I don't think we've discussed, but for people to think about, is how the media has approached the coverage of abortion and the fact that, again, you have a president who couldn't even say the word. There's nothing wrong with that word.
Like, own it.
Because quote unquote liberal media, i.e. liberals that are wishy-washy, don't have a way to put a foot in the ground and say, no. There is no shame in saying the word abortion. That is what it is. It is a medical procedure.
Yeah. Can I say hysterectomy? Can I say vasectomy? Can I say, like, you know, come on.
Exacto. But male dominated media then just like, oh, we can't really even talk about abortion, because then if we talk about it, then they're going to think that we are actually pro-abortion. And we don't. It's like you are pro-privacy, pro-choice.
Yeah.
So the role of the media and how they have set up the narrative that, again, has been pushed, as we said, for decades by a very long, plain conservative movement in the United States. And this is how we end up.
This is when this country's like religious past comes into all this, right?
Yeah.
The shame. I grew up Catholic. I've rejected Catholicism and institutional Catholicism. And I'm a different type of spiritual person now.
Yeah.
But, you know, growing up in that Catholic space, that was forced down your throat, right? Anyone who dared talk about being pro-choice was seen as, you know, immoral and a mortal sinner. So I think that's part of this. And I think, you know, Joe Biden being a staunch Catholic, even though he's pro-choice, it's generational. I mean, I say this all the time about Joe Biden, and God bless my father-in-law, So may he rest in peace, my Boston Irish father-in-law, who I loved to death. But that's that generation, right? The sort of Catholic men in their 70s and 80s who grew up in that sort of repressed time. And, you know, I give Biden credit for trying to adapt, but in the end,
I think, yeah,
you're just a repressed Catholic boy. And so I think that's part of this as well.
Well, you really gave us that good take right there.
But Democrats and the media, like, why can't we push through this in 2022, right?
Reframe it. It is about privacy, 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 privacy.
Right. And ultimately, this whole telling people to go out to vote, I mean, it's just not enough. In the sense of people have gone out to vote,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially your base,
mm-hmm.
Black women, Latinos and Latinas, indigenous people, like Asian Americans, they've gone out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you're going to continue to tell them, like, go out to vote. Abortion and reproductive rights are on the line now, right now.
Right now.
And so we just need to see some more urgency from the Democrats. Of course, In the Thick, Futuro Media, you know, our podcast, Latino USA, Latino Rebels, we're going to be watching how all this plays out, especially how it will affect other rights and protections for vulnerable communities.
Absolutely. So, dear listener, as you know, we've been on this and we are not going to stay off of this. These are the topics that are important and matter to all of us. So right now, let's go to the tape.
There are other ways in which we've been failed. It's been a failure of imagination in terms of where women deserve to be all together by both political parties. Uno, dos,
tres. Hey, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us from Laguna Beach, California is Dr. Michelle Goodwin. She's a law professor at the University of California, Irvine. She's host of Ms. Magazine's On the Issues podcast.
Nice.
And she's the author of the new book, Policing the Womb. Multitasker Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be with you.
So happy you're here. And joining us from the other side of the country, Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, is Mary Ziegler. She's a law professor at Florida State University. She's a historian and author of the new book, Abortion and the Law in America. Welcome, Mary.
And thanks for having me.
So you get the idea of what we're talking about, people.
Yeah.
We're talking about reproductive justice.
Mm.
And how women of color are too often criminalized in this country around the issue of reproductive justice. And as you know, this is a very sweet spot for me, yep. like a very personal one. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about this update with the Breonna Taylor case, which has been, for women, just not a slap in the face. It's like we're getting pummeled. So just to recap the backstory of Breonna Taylor. Back in March, she's a 26-year-old emergency medical technician, was shot multiple times and killed when Louisville police raided her home.
Mm.
Last week, a grand jury charged only one officer, Brett Hankinson, in the shooting for wanton endangerment. You know, he was the one whose shots actually hit the neighbors' homes.
Right.
So not Breonna.
That's right.
Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron said that the officers had acted in quote-unquote self-defense. But as of this recording on Monday afternoon, he has yet to release the transcripts from the grand jury's deliberations. On Friday, Breonna Taylor's family and lawyers held a news conference. Breonna's mother, Tamika Palmer, released a statement. It was read by her sister, who is Breonna's aunt. Her name is Bianca Austin.
Yeah. I knew Cameron would never do his job, but what I do know is that him and countless others will go to bed sleeping with Breonna's face, still hearing her say her name.
Yeah. That's right.
Cameron alone didn't fail her, but it ended with the lack of investigation failed her.
Mm.
The officer who told a lie to obtain a search warrant failed her.
Mm.
The judge who signed the search warrant failed her. The terrorist who broke down her door failed her.
Mm.
The system as a whole has failed her.
Mm.
You didn't just rob me of my and my family. You robbed the world of a queen.
Mm.
A queen willing to do a job that most of us could never stomach to do. A queen willing to build up anyone around her. A queen who was starting to pave her path.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you never have to know the pain of knowing your child is in need and help and you're not able to give them. Mm. I hope you never hear the sounds of seeing someone cry and beg for your child to get help and she never receives help. Those cries was ignored. I hope you never know the pain of your child being murdered 191 days in a row. Mm. Tamika Palmer.
So, Michelle, you know, really,
yeah.
The question is, do you reform a system like that? Or, I mean, it doesn't feel like you can reform a system that right here is saying, oh, right, the only officer we're going to charge is the one who hit the neighbor's home.
So, Maria, you know, we live in a society that begs us to suspend our intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be clear about that. Mm-hmm. Because we know that she died, her body riddled of bullets. And many people believe in the criminal justice system that what it does is to see something like that. And then the outcome is that this innocent person sleeping in her own bed in the middle of the night, an essential care worker during these times, that if she is harmed, there is justice on the other side of it. But the criminal justice system engaged with Black people's lives, especially Black women's lives, has historically then not rendered that last result, which is justice. And that's historically so. So let's remember that historically police forces were slave patrols in the United States. The very right. same model of the badge is the same model of the badge from the 16 and 1700s as the slave patrol, the earliest policing laws in the United States, the earliest laws related to homicide, made it not a crime to kill Black people, right? So you could, because Black people were considered property,
right.
property can't be killed. Mm-hmm. So you see these cases involving mm-hmm. that, whether it was Black people being maimed, Black people being murdered, any of those things that white people were just not held to account for it. And even in the cases of those things that happen to be the most egregious, horrific, let's think about Emmett Till's death, still no conviction, even after people admit to doing what they have done, or the murder of the four little Black girls in that Alabama church, 16th Street Baptist Church, and so many of them maimed mm-hmm. with wire recordings knowing exactly who did it. No arrest, no convictions for decades. So in that historical light, we're still looking for a constitution that adequately fulfills its promise to Black women.
Wow. Mary, mm-hmm. your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a good segue to what we're talking about today. I think even with the Say Her Name campaign, it's so much easier to forget about what happens to Black women in the justice system versus even to Black men. And I think that's one of the reasons this conversation is so important. Often when people talk about mass incarceration or criminal justice reform, they're not thinking about women and they're not talking about women, which is one of the reasons Breonna Taylor's story is so important. But it's also a good reminder of how these criminal justice issues go beyond just the sorts of concerns about the police and about right. police violence and police brutality that we've all been talking about. They go even into the sort of most intimate corners of our lives, which are the kinds of things Michelle and I have been studying.
You know, and I would add to that too, it's important to note that in the backdrop of what happened to Breonna Taylor, it wasn't until George Floyd's horrific lynching murder that we all saw that then people said, well, let's pay attention to Breonna Taylor too, because recall that she was murdered weeks before he was.
Correct.
Right. And, you know, and it just takes that. And it's so unfortunate, the sort of devaluing of Black women's lives such that it has to be an appendage to something else horrific happening for people to begin paying attention to the denigration right, right. and the harm of Black women. And that's just historically been so. Mm-hmm. We've been several hundred years into this enterprise of a failure to take seriously and to honor the lives of Black women, the ways in which their bodies have been abused through rape and sexual assault, the foundations of our nation and slavery papered over, but so real. I mean, and one example of that is think about Monticello, literally the papering over of Sally Hemings' bedroom.
Yes.
The woman who was raped by Thomas Jefferson. He took her to France, sired children with her. Every element of this we've not yet dealt with
right.
in our country. And then literally her bedroom papered over and turned into a restroom
oh,
at Monticello.
God.
until Charlottesville, right? So it takes something like the murder of Heather Heyer then, and a coming to grips with these issues in Virginia in order for there to be a reckoning at Monticello about the life of Sally Hemings. Mm. And even the offspring of Jefferson, the Black offspring of Jefferson, the pleas, the efforts over decades and decades for their due recognition. You know, it all is a part of what has been, sadly, an American conspiracy to actually hide what has happened to Black women foundationally in this country.
All right. I'm just saying that is an American conspiracy.
Yeah.
In terms of who's writing the history and the policy.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So many dots are being connected. And as we shift to discuss about reproductive rights, it really is all connected. And the work that both of you have done.
Absolutely. Let's think about Sojourner Truth, right? So when Sojourner Truth says in the 1800s in her famous Ain't I a Woman speech, most people remember it as a speech about chivalry. But it's actually in that speech she says, and I bore 13 children, and nearly each one snatched from my arms, and nobody heard my cry but God, ain't I a woman?
Making those connections.
But we still have to talk about the latest, right? With the Supreme Court, with the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, President Trump has already announced his nominee, Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who is a judge on the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And this was Barrett in 2016 talking about Roe v. Wade at Jacksonville University.
I don't think that abortion or the right to abortion would change.
Do you think some of the restrictions might change?
I think some of the restrictions would change. I think that's what we just saw last term in the case out of Texas. States, after the Kermit Gosnell affair and all of that, states have imposed regulations on abortion clinics. And I think the question is how much freedom the court is willing to let states have in regulating abortion. I think the question of, you know, the court has held that in some circumstances, states can render partial birth abortion illegal, very late term abortions. I think that's the kind of thing that would change. I don't think the core case, the Roe's core holding that, you know, women have a right to an abortion, I don't think that would change. But I think the question of whether people can get very late term abortions, you know, how many restrictions can be put on clinics, I think that would change. Mm.
So we talked last week, right, about the hypocrisy of Republicans pushing through a nominee during an election year, right? It's an election year, you know, it's only weeks away. So we want to get into what the implications are of having a conservative nominee for Roe v. Wade.
So, Mary, you already tweeted out that Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation could, in fact, mean the end of Roe.
Yeah.
I mean, it just could. In fact, Mary, in the first sentence of your book, you write, quote, with the Supreme Court likely to reverse Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion decision, American debate appears fixated on clashing rights. And your book really complicates the idea that the Supreme Court is solely responsible for the divisions over abortion rights and the backlash against it. Mm. There are a handful of cases that may, in fact, reach the highest court of the country soon, which will have a direct impact on reproductive rights. And I just want to remind people that the essence of Roe v. Wade is privacy.
Right. Mary, so is this the end of Roe?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, you're saying it's the end of Roe. So what does this mean for abortion and reproductive rights for women, and particularly women of color in this country? If you're just saying this could be the end, this is the end of Roe v. Wade.
Well, if you think about it, we already had a conservative Supreme Court majority. John Roberts is not a liberal savior. There's no real converts to the cause of reproductive justice among the court's conservative members as it was. So you can almost view Amy Coney Barrett as kind of an insurance policy that reproductive rights will be overturned. Because then even if you have, say, someone like John Roberts or, you know, someone else who kind of breaks ranks with the rest of the conservatives, that's not enough anymore. It's also, I think, of all the court's members, if you look at Amy Coney Barrett, she's been the most, I think, kind of vocal about her views being anti-abortion of the court's current members. Now, in some ways, that doesn't really matter. I mean, if you're opposed to reproductive justice because you're, you know, just whatever, you're a misogynist or you're just conservative and you don't like Roe v. Wade for some other reason, the outcome is the same, but we have less reason to doubt that she will kind of blink when the time comes. Mm. It's a big deal, and it's especially a big deal for women of color. It's a big deal because Amy Coney Barrett's presence on the court doesn't just extend to abortion. It also extends to contraceptive access. It extends to what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act. And as we know, because of racial bias in this country, whenever there is less privacy in making reproductive decisions, or whenever we get rid of things like the Affordable Care Act, the people who bear the brunt of that are women of color, right? So historically, it's always been easier for women with money, and that's historically disproportionately been white women, to navigate around any kind of restrictions that have been put in place. That's always been much harder. I mean, the rate of deaths for Black women has always been higher. It was much higher before Roe than it was for white women. We'd expect that to continue. And I think maybe even become more pronounced. I mean, it's sad to say how little progress we've made when it comes to racial justice in this country. But then when the bill comes due for what it would mean to overturn Roe, that's going to be women of color paying the bill.
Wow.
Can I just ask, and you know, people know I'm super honest on this show. I actually had two abortions. So I realize now that my abortions happened just after Roe v. Wade had been legal for about a decade. So really in the early 1980s. But when we think about this nominee, what is up? Just a moment, please. Help me, talk me down, because I had to stop watching The Handmaid's Tale. And what made me stop watching The Handmaid's Tale was when all of the women were told that they had to leave their offices because there were no more women allowed at work. So Amy Coney Barrett is a member of a particularly conservative Christian faith group. It's called People of Praise. Newsweek reported that the group, quote, teaches that husbands should assume authority as the head of the household. In fact, her parents are members, and her father was a coordinator of the group's chapters in the South. And that was reported by NPR. So talk me down on this. Does this matter at all when we're talking about women of color, reproductive rights, you know, and the Supreme Court?
I guess to me, how much you want to freak out depends on your time horizon. So if you really want to freak out, the history of the abortion debate would suggest that the anti-abortion movement as a whole, even if you don't need to worry about specific faith groups or Amy Coney Barrett, the anti-abortion movement as a whole, the goal has been to ban all abortions. The goal is not to overturn Roe v. Wade. That's like a way station on the road. The goal is a right to life. And the right to life, if you kind of follow the logic, would mean that abortion is illegal everywhere, right? It's illegal in California. It's illegal in New York. It's illegal if you've been raped. It's illegal if you're a minor. It's definitely illegal if you're a woman of color. Like that's the end game. I think in the short term, though, we still have a lot of conservatives who are interested to some degree in saving face. Chief Justice Roberts is in that camp. Probably Brett Kavanaugh is in that camp after the kind of disastrous confirmation hearings he had.
Dr. Ford has described you as being intoxicated at a party. Did you consume alcohol during your high school years?
Yes, we drank beer. My friends and I, the boys and girls. Yes, we drank beer. I liked beer. Still like beer.
And Amy Coney Barrett might be in that camp too. A lot of these people want to act as if they're not partisans, even if they are. And that doesn't mean that Roe v. Wade is safe, but it does mean that it might take longer to unravel abortion rights. And there's some hope in that, because of course, the longer it takes, the more uncertainty there is. So then you might have, for example, retirements on the conservative side or deaths on the conservative side. You might have court packing if that's a road the Democrats decide to go down. So if you're looking for kind of absolute certainty in the near term, we might not get The Handmaid's Tale now, but we're going to get some kind of rollback of abortion rights. But, you know, make no mistake that where it's going is an absolute prohibition nationwide of abortion rights.
Yeah. Michelle,
all right.
What's your take on the debate with Roe and the potential of having another, I mean, it's going to happen, another conservative judge. I just want to get your takes.
Even after Roe, there were challenges put in place for poor women, women of color, with the Hyde Amendment, a series of Supreme Court cases that preferenced pregnancy, the state funding pregnancy versus pregnancy termination, even in the wake of data that we know that an abortion is as safe as a penicillin shot. even though we know that a person is 14 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term in the United States than terminating it. I mean, we really need to look at this for what that is. You know, when the state says, no, we prefer that you do this, even though we know it's 14 times more likely to kill you, poor women and women of color, what then is that?
Yeah.
Men are not placed with those kinds of ultimatums. I mean, that really then places in context the very deadly nature of what the state is playing around with in terms of the lives of poor women and women of color. And I'd like to, you know, expound upon what Mary so eloquently put before us, to think then about what the court will be doing with another conservative justice in terms of voting rights, criminal justice, the environment. Mm-hmm. All of these issues matter. Immigration, right? So that we must understand when we think about reproductive health rights and justice within, you know, a whole person's context, which is that there are many different ways of undermining somebody's liberty and rendering them without the value of their personhood. Hello. And it won't be just reproductive rights, which are critically important. But what thinking about these issues in a holistic way means that we really are talking about Jim Crow kind of politics returning to the United States. And we already see this in front of us. When you have a government that's putting children in cages, separating them from their parents' arms, forcing people who are at meatpacking plants that are riddled with COVID-19 to go back to work. When you have a government that thinks that little of the lives of people of color, then that is Jim Crow. Now, we can paper it over with the fact that there now we've gotten rid of certain forms of discrimination in education, though we see the lingering effects still in housing, though we still see the lingering effects of that still in voting, though we still see the lingering effects of it. The reality is that for those people of color who have the means to somehow hopscotch over so many of the substantial barriers that have been put in the place, not just abortion, but just living an equal life than everybody else, in many ways are returning to a kind of Jim Crow status.
Absolutely.
And that's not hyperbole.
Right.
That's real for all of the Black women who had to stand in line in Wisconsin during the pandemic this summer in the primary to vote for hours. And, you know, in thinking about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of her last dissents was exactly about that. You know, this sort of underlying racism, really, with how the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court handle that, which was to say, if you want to vote, then risk your life to do so. But we're not going to make it easier for you to be able to vote. And let's be clear, in Wisconsin, at the time of that primary, though, Black people constitute 6% of that state. There were 40% of the deaths.
Hi, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA. We all love great stories, and great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you every week. Latino USA presents a mix of reporting on culture and politics, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues, featuring stories from the heart, stories that will make you think and maybe even inspire you. Listen to Latino USA on your favorite podcast app from PRX. So if we look at the history of reproductive rights for women of color and for immigrant women, there, as you're saying, there are clear roots of racism in the anti-abortion movement. Michelle, in your book, which you first conceptualized 20 years ago, you write about how the laws, many of these laws are from the quote-unquote so-called war on drugs that have been constructed to police and criminalize pregnant women, women of color. In your introduction, you start with this line: this is not a work of fiction, although I wish it were.
Right. And you write, while we may think of The Handmaid's Tale, actually, this is the United States, or specifically Texas, when you recount the story of Marlise Munoz in 2013, who was brain dead and decomposing and was forced by the state to gestate for nearly 2 months before she was finally taken off organ support after a legal battle. The state literally had control of her body her husband and parents had no say. There was no say because of, quote unquote, fetal protection. So that story's so visceral, right? It tells you that, you know, the way in your book, how you humanize the women criminalized and victimized by these laws.
And, you know, we've been covering the recent reports of these forced sterilizations of immigrant women in detention. Mm-hmm. It's not a surprise. It is the natural next step. We have, in fact, been screaming about this. Some of us journalists, we've been talking about the sexual abuse that is continuous in these places. And it's really nothing new for women of color, for immigrants, for Black women, for poor women. We go back all the way to slavery, to eugenics. In your book, you interview Loretta Ross, who's one of the leaders of the term and the movement reproductive justice, who directly links the attempt to control women with white supremacy and patriarchy. And actually, let's listen to a clip of Loretta herself speaking with the Western States Center.
Well, the beauty of the reproductive justice framework is that it is the isolation of abortion from other social justice issues. Mm-hmm. And so it allows us to have the conversation about abortion at the same time we're talking about white supremacy or economic injustice or welfare rights or HIV/AIDS or housing or police brutality, all the other things that go on in our community that are also human rights violations, because it is a human rights-based framework. And so I think that is our best ally right now, that mm-hmm. we have an intersectional, inclusive framework that allows us to have conversations with people who are uncomfortable maybe only focusing on abortion. Because, you know, reproductive justice is the right to have a child and not have a child, and to parent our kids as we talk about it. Mm-hmm.
So that's really interesting, because there was this photograph that I remember seeing as a young woman. It was in Ms. Magazine, and it was a woman curled up in a pile of blood after a botched abortion. Mm. And that was one of the things that made me become committed to reproductive justice. But in your book, Michelle, you actually call for Congress to enact a reproductive justice bill of rights that would hold those in power accountable and protecting women, including trans women's personhood. So talk to us about this history of policing women of color and their bodies, and about this bill that you're calling for.
Well, thank you so much for that. So if we think about, if we do a thought experiment, and I think it's really important to do this kind of thought experiment because we're so divorced from our history, which is, you know, to imagine that it's not just for an hour that we were to see women on an auction block, stripped naked, forced to bend over, people doing cavity searches of them before they purchase them. And then to justify it to themselves that this is okay because she's not a human being. And she might be standing on this auction block with her children. Mm. People would say, well, you don't have to worry about them either because they're not human beings. They're just like a pig or goat or sheep. This is what chattel is. This is what it means to be property. Now, if we had to watch that continuously for 15 minutes in a movie, there would be some people ready to leave the theater saying that's gratuitous. Right. That's way too much. Oh my gosh, we had to watch 15 minutes of that. But imagine a country that decides that it will enact laws and protect the people who actually engage in that, and that they do it not just 15 minutes, not just an hour, not just 24 hours, not just a week, not just a month, not just a year, more than a decade, and decades that flow into centuries, regularly picking up the billet to bid on these women, their children, snatching the children away from these women. And these women have no recourse because their own children are not considered their children, because property can't have children.
Wow.
And property can't have property. Right. And it's that really important piece that then flows and serves as a foundation in our country. By the time we get to eugenics being legalized in our country, it's part of the post-reconstruction, reconstruction.
Yes.
All of our American memory.
I.e., it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
And it's not a surprise.
And then you look at the anti-immigrant movement based on eugenics, that this is a line that spans centuries without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Without
That's
a doubt.
Exactly right. I mean, you can see it. And what's interesting are the various forces that then enable this white supremacy. These forces that up until just a few years ago fail to apologize and recognize it. So the American Medical Association, for example, deeply engaged in this practice, right? The American Medical Association becomes a vehicle for white supremacists who want to keep Black midwives and indigenous midwives and women out of reproductive health care. They end up being a tremendous force for lobbying with anti-immigration policies. They even propose some of their own. They become instrumental in states' eugenics policies as well. They even become an active force in trying to get rid of Black medical schools using, interestingly enough, the excuse that Black medical schools allow women in. So you just can't make up this history. And in 1927, you see the Supreme Court essentially sanctioning all of this by upholding a Virginia eugenics law. Now, there have been eugenics laws already for two decades in the United States, but by the Supreme Court's decision in 1927 in Buck v. Bell, they legitimized the forced sterilization of people who were considered to be unfit Americans.
Right. Right.
I love when the law professors just drop the case numbers, because that's when I'm like, I need to go to law school. Mary, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Maria said about the image of the white woman in blood, that really speaks to something both Michelle and I have studied. And I think one of the things that's striking, even in more recent history, even on the pro-choice side, is how often the pro-choice movement was really kind of willing to sacrifice women of color. One reminder of this, right, is the recent sort of shift in the Democratic Party on the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment deals with abortion funding. And of course, who needs abortion funding? Well, it's disproportionately low-income women, and that's disproportionately women of color. So when the Hyde Amendment was first passed, the pro-choice movement didn't fight it very hard. Now, part of that was just naivete, because they assumed the Supreme Court would get rid of it. But part of it was because, to some degree, they didn't care as much, right? Donors didn't respond to it because the donors were white and it didn't affect them. And voters didn't respond to it because they were racist and didn't care as much about the women who were being affected by it. All of this was so true that support for the Hyde Amendment was part of a kind of bipartisan consensus until 2016, even as the Democratic Party became clearly the pro-choice party. So when you think even about, you know, progressives in this country, until recently, there was a sort of consensus that progressives were pro-choice, but, you know, pro-choice for whom, right? It wasn't always clear that extended to women of color, or if it did extend to women of color, that progressives were willing to fight for women of color, right? Even if they were in principle thought that women of color should have reproductive rights and reproductive justice, it was sort of, well, that's great, but we don't want to lose Roe v. Wade, or we don't want to sacrifice too much, or
don't want to upset
white men. Yeah. Exactly.
Just settle.
Women of color have been an afterthought. And you could think about that even as we celebrate the ratification of the 19th Amendment, right? So even with voting rights, you see white women who considered themselves progressive, yet engaging in racism and racist campaigns, actually appealing to white supremacists in order to be able to gain the right to vote, sort of the trade-off being, we'll put Black women to the background. Right. We won't have them march with us. So long as white women can secure the right to vote, Black women and Indigenous women and Latinx women and Asian women one day will get their turn, but it just won't be now.
You know, it's interesting because this Tuesday night is the first 2020 presidential debate. So we're recording this ahead of that. But we know that even during the countless Democratic primary debates of the 2020 season, reproductive rights just lacked extensive coverage, right? Mm-hmm. It only came up a few times. And one of those times was only because Senator Kamala Harris brought it up herself.
This is the sixth debate we have had in this presidential cycle, and not nearly one word, with all of these discussions about health care, on women's access to reproductive health care, which is under full-on attack in America today.
So they weren't even asking the question. So she's like, let's go. So now we have two white men on stage Tuesday night. They've had problems. You know, there have been allegations.
Very different kinds of problems.
Right. Different kinds of problems. We also have a white male moderator on Tuesday night.
It's so white. It's the shining whiteness of it all.
Trump has nominated a number of conservative federal judges. And if Barrett is confirmed, like we said, there'll be another conservative justice to SCOTUS. Biden says he wants to pass federal legislation to protect the right to an abortion, but he has flipped on some things. And one of them, which Mary has already brought up, the Hyde Amendment. So let's kind of get into this debate. How do you expect this topic to be covered in the debates? And Trump and Biden, what are they going to say? Mary, what do you think? I threw a lot your way.
Well, I think if you start with the debate, I think Trump has had a track record of wanting to talk more about abortion. Biden is seeming to pursue a strategy of thinking that abortion or reproductive justice issues generally are sort of too divisive. I mean, on the merits, who knows if that's right as a matter of strategy. Yeah. But it seems a little bit troubling that Biden seems to be prioritizing the views of, say, like white independence, which is presumably the group he's trying not to make uncomfortable, over the views of the people of color who really lead in the nominee, right?
Exactly. Like black women who voted for him.
Hello.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a little bit, you know, talking about abortion at all is, of course, a way of talking about women of color, because women of color are the ones who are going to lose out the most if Roe v. Wade is gone. And a reluctance to talk about that is a little bit creepy, because it does bring to mind this sort of history of ignoring women of color when it comes to reproductive justice, which the Democratic Party has been guilty of in the past. In terms of what's going to happen, I mean, to some degree, the Supreme Court is probably going to be extremely conservative and likely undo Roe v. Wade almost, you know, regardless of who's president, unless we have some kind of court packing or retirement by the Democrats, which, of course, introduces uncertainty. If Trump is president, you can pretty much take it to the bank that you're going to have a pretty big rollback of abortion rights. Yeah. And probably an overruling of Roe. You're going to see, you know, continuing dismantling of contraceptive access. You're probably going to see more conservative Christians in positions of power trying to limit access to other things like sex education. And like Michelle said, you're also going to see kind of undercutting of other programs like healthcare or, you know, employment protections, employment discrimination protections, all the things that make it hard for women of color who do want to have children to actually do it when they want to without facing kind of impossible life choices. So you're going to see more of that.
Yeah. Michelle.
And let's be clear on that point, too, Mary. Thank you so much for that, which is that women of color will only be the canaries in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. Which is a point that I emphasize in my book. So if we look at criminalization of pregnant women, it began as Black and Latina women. But once you establish a precedent and that accelerant is put on that precedent, then white women become vulnerable too.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And you exactly. see that in Alabama, where in the last few years, hundreds of white women arrested for endangering their fetuses under a law that was never intended for pregnant women, a law that was originally designed to try to deter folks who turn their homes into meth labs, who were blowing up their homes and their trailers. And so legislators passed a law, a child endangerment law, that would seek to discourage men from making meth in their homes. But who did prosecutors go after? Pregnant women through the complicity yeah. of doctors. But I want to go back to the debate question. And even if you don't mind thinking back just a few years ago, I know
go
I keep
it.
Nipping back, but I
no,
think
no,
it's really so
awesome.
Important because these things don't come out of thin air, right? So
right.
why in 2016 were there not questions about sexual assault and rape mm. during the debate?
Right.
You had a federal judge that said, okay, we'll let this lawsuit go forward where there is an allegation of rape against one of the candidates. Now, all of this time about emails, but yet no questions about a federal judge saying, okay, this case involving an allegation of rape, no questions.
Yeah.
I mean, this says so much about our country and about the value of the lives of girls and women in the United States. And of course, foundationally, a nation that said it was permissible for men to rape their wives.
Exactly.
Right? That would give them yeah. an out both criminally and also in civil law, that it's mm-hmm. okay to actually beat your wife so long as the instrument you use is no thicker than your thumb. So that is, you know, a foundation, but also strategy too.
Exactly.
Right. So as folks are looking at this current nominee, a question should be raised about the opportunity that was had during the Obama administration. Because let's be clear, this was not just a question about Merrick Garland. There was actually a deeper strategy. The Obama administration could have been the one to say, and we're going to put forward another woman too. And we're going to put forward another woman of
right.
color. And we're going to put
yeah.
forward a Black woman. And
yeah.
we will dare you Senate Republicans and Senate Democrats to not give her her day.
Yeah.
And then you have a different kind of narrative and strategy going forward in terms of women getting in the streets. Now, you know, instead, who's going to get in the streets? And they should have, sure, for Merrick Garland. But Merrick Garland looked kind of like so many other Supreme Court justices that we've had in the past. But imagine had a woman not been given her due by Mitch McConnell, rather than the marches that came in January and February.
Yeah.
They would have come in March and April and May and June leading up to November. Yeah. And so there are other ways in which we've been failed that are not just Republican. It's been a failure of imagination in terms of where women deserve to be altogether by both political parties.
Now we're going to take this conversation. We're going to move on to our final segment, which we call binge-worthy.
I love that.
What are you binging on?
So what's something that you've watched, read, seen, something that it's just kind of got your attention? You know, it can be, I'm like a bird who appeared at your bird feeder this weekend, like me. Although I do have one I'm about to share. So let's start with you, Michelle, real quick. What is something that you've been binging on?
Well, right now, I live in Laguna Beach and we have goats on our hills to munch down some of this earth, some of this growth so that we don't get wildfires here. So I've been binging on hearing their bleeding and seeing them out my window.
You know, Michelle is clearly from my team, Julio. Just so we're clear.
Definitely your team.
She connects to nature. Yeah. I look at birds. Yeah. She looks at goats. Okay, Mary, something that you're binge-worthy.
I'm binging on the lack of tourists where I am because our governor has said that COVID is officially over, so we can all go back to bars with thousands of people. And thankfully, all the tourists in my area are insane and think that when the weather is actually decent in Florida, it's time to stop coming. So now I can leave my house without getting COVID. So I'm binging on the empty sidewalks, the empty streets. Everything is empty. And that's amazing.
Wow.
Julio, are you binging on something you want to let us know about?
I'm watching all soccer documentaries and soccer reels on Instagram. It's amazing. I get to see all these skills and think that I'm still old enough to play the game, which I do.
Why don't we have a good men's U.S. team?
Oh, boy.
We're moving on. Get more Latinos. Get more Latinos. All right. What about you, Maria? What about you?
I am binging on a TV show that actually touches on these issues. I was looking for something a little light. It's called Greenleaf.
Prodigal daughter returns.
Daddy.
It's good having you back.
Promise me you're not here to sow discord in the fields of my peace. Nice to see you too, Mama.
You are on a path to be my equal.
You're going to ask her to take my place?
The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
The church has deacons for a reason. Checks and balances. You seem to be only interested in the checks.
I saw that.
It's a black production and it deals with incest, sexual abuse, rape, the church. I mean,
it's a hot mess.
It's a hot mess with these mega churches in the South, but it's an all black cast and it's really, really great acting. So that's what I'm binging on.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Michelle Goodwin, law professor at the University of California, Irvine, and Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University. Thank you so much for dropping so much wisdom on this episode of In the Thick with Julio and me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno.
Listener, please go to Apple Podcasts right now to rate and review us, because where else are you going to hear a conversation like this? No place. Also, remember, you can listen to us on all major podcast platforms. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone that you see or don't see to listen. In The Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, Lisa Salinas, and our fellow Sarah Hershander, with editorial support from Charlotte Manjin. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. Remember, no te vayas. And thank you so much for listening. See you later.
Peace, y'all. this is a very loose conversation. Think of us being at a dinner table with several bottles of wine.
That's the kind of conversation I like to have.
Yeah.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.